this is a system so that if anyone is not here, they can call in remotely. And it's recording us now. This is to mute, so you want to make sure it's not muted. This is to start the video, which you can start it, stop it if you want. Doesn't really matter. This green here is to show that it's actually picking up the sound. And then once the meeting is over, you hit end meeting. If there's ever a reason you need to pause the recording, you can hit pause and you can hit play there. Continue to play it. Again, when it's over, end. You remember that's the stop, that's the mute. Anyone can call in using this ID. So sometimes people might be calling in, so just, you know. There's a glitch within the system right now. So that's why it says that you won't be able to see it from that end. So they're working on that.
It's okay. I just tell them we have five people in our office, so
this is a backup recorder that we use now, just in case. And so, this is the turning on. Just hold it.
Does that mean it's no longer having the face report?
That would follow because it has to be the piece of that.
And then what you're going to want to do is hit record and then it will start recording. Well, you want to hit it twice. So it has to be not pulsing, but solid red. And then you see the time actually going.
So there you go. So in a way, they're currently
Richard, how are
you? Two vacancies.
Terrible.
We're on the hate speech working group.
Hi, Richard.
Hi, Richard.
So there are two vacancies in the hate speech working group for members from the CBC.
Yes, we have one undergrad.
Hello, how are you today?
What are you doing here?
You don't work here
anymore.
Oh,
okay.
I'm actually just helping Michael get set up.
I see. So that she's the new. Yes, she'll be replacing me for the UA at this moment.
So we don't get to get on. Yeah, I'm on the UA still, and I mean, who knows? I could come back one day. Who knows? Anything is possible.
You kept this in the dark.
Right? Here's the charger.
It's usually just
it's charged. What you can do is you can turn it like this if you want. But you just want to make sure, I guess, that you can still see what's happening here.
Although we have minutes.
Apparently, yeah, they were sent out. We do have minutes. They were just sent out. Or do you know how late my mom's is time for that? So.
Do you know how you're going to type have you ever typed minutes before? You have.
I have, like, in high school.
Okay. Let's see what I usually do.
I don't know if we're going to have food things in the snow.
Usually Matt sends out the agenda. So you want to find his agenda that he sent out?
Those come in and get Tin City and Frederick Blacker.
Yes.
Sure. Because I took out the Harvey and something before I know.
Oh, thanks. You're welcome. There you
go.
Thank you. Okay. It's
how's she doing?
Huh?
How is she doing?
She's doing well. Yeah. How are you today?
I'm terrible.
Terrible?
Richard.
I'm
so sorry to hear that.
Yeah.
So there are two undergrads from the student assembly, essentially. One of them. Two employees.
Yes, he's working with eight people. Two for contingency. One from CJT, one from the assembly.
So,
two from the assembly.
Three from the UA. Any two members plus the chair.
Yes.
Okay. And those two members could be from any.
Those two members. They must be UA members.
So right now, one of the undergrads is staff.
Yeah, you.
And then the graduates.
One is staff.
One is staff. The employees.
Employees are both staff. That's Chief John and Recruiter. And then the faculty. I'm trying to clarify for the status, but Fresh Putnam recently quits. And the UA, it's me, Rena, Mr. Bensel, And then, well, I'm missing here. Oh, G, G, oh yeah, it was Victoria, and then right now, MG, so. It is 4:30, which is the form. That being said, as I noted in the email, I didn't understand that many people could not attend. I think it's just because it is snowing. I'm here anyway, so I suppose we'll begin. That being said, it's going to be a little more than people. But anyway, so first on our agenda would be approval of minutes, which were sent out this afternoon by the office. We appreciate that greatly. Because no one has had really a chance to review them, I'm going to ask them. Actually, they will be going out in advance in a way such as that. They're not going out quite early in the morning. But that also relates to that point. So I don't think there's any sense to table those. Bring on the table. For the record, also, in terms of our doodle poll, trying to find the meeting time, as I was telling everyone before we started, we have about half of the meeting turned over, so that makes it a little more challenging. Many things are being filled, and therefore we're moving forward in that area. I also am obliged to notify the committee that I was notified at least 3 o'clock sharp by the chairman of the Mr. Coffin, the chairman of the assembly, that his meeting of some had been removed from this committee by the action of the executive committee of the assembly. He said, yes, I called him to get more information. I have that chance to call him to direct the class. I called him later this evening to discuss exactly what happened, but all I know at this moment is that this is no longer on our committee. And therefore, that means the chairmanship of the Haitian Working Group is taken. So, I know Professor Leibowitz has an offer to do it previously. So I have reached out to her to notify, notify her that she's still going to do it. I don't know. I have any emails that you more or less 2 seconds that I was told. He's been removed from this immediate effect by the executive committee. And call more information. I was meeting, it mentioned that the document is confidential. Again, I don't necessarily know what's going on. I didn't receive your notice. And because of that, I feel obligated to inform this committee. I hope that it's not, but we are going to have to, get a third try. I know Reese will do it. So I'm hopeful that that is not changing the week. I have reached out to her. I'll follow up to make sure that he still will do so, but unless it's an issue, I'm more qualified and not having mortgage to my family. So that's what we have there. That's about it. Scheduling, as I said, we have beautiful hours, we have energy turned over. Once we get beautiful, I know there's talk moving back to bi-weekly. Some people have said 4:30 slot opposite UA meetings, so there's a UA meeting on one Tuesday, Tuesday announcements. Working with the thrown in as necessary. That might work. I still need to see where it applies, and I will be sure that that'll be going on the email. Hopefully, gets to a formal schedule. And said, "Turn over." Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. On Wednesday, right? Yeah. We'll ruin Tuesdays, hopefully, for that. Yeah. So the opposite UA meeting. So UA would be 4:30 on one Tuesday.
So we do it every other week.
That's what we might be doing. I'm not sure. We still need to see what the availability is. And I will send this out in an email and any concerns we'd like to address. But the idea was that was presented to me was that we go from meeting right now on paper. This is a working session on our calendar. Right now, it's virtually indistinguishable. Some people have said that weekly meetings they can't make, their phone rings, et cetera. So we would set bi-weekly full committee meetings, and then we'd have weekly sessions as needed on the off weeks, assuming we need them. That was what was proposed. We are free to do that, to not do that, or tweak it as we see fit. But I want to make sure that everyone's aware of where we might be going. Sticking to the agenda, the next item is coincidentally the Haiti's Working Group. So, as I mentioned, we're contacting, I already mentioned Arisa will be likely serving as the chair of that and as it moves forward. I know scheduling should be getting underway, and we'll be as much as I'm trying to let them be independent, considering that we have another vacancy in the chair, I will be doing everything I can to ensure that they are at least moving forward, and the committee is not prohibiting the curse. I would really don't believe that's the case. They have important work, so we'll hope to get them off the ground. Are there any questions on that? Hearing none, this appears to be the I Can Talk a Lot show. Next up is the previously planned housekeeping changes to the code. So this is actually the attachment. You may recognize this. This is similar to what we circulated back in the fall. These are all the code changes that were passed by the committee, and the president's response is listed on the left. So if there's no objections, I can run through them really quick. If anyone has any questions, please do jump in. As much as I am perfectly happy to talk, this is not the Matthew Tagway Committee, it's the Code Supervision Committee. So anyways, first up was the suspension length, statute of limitations, and organizations being given an extended statute of limitations. She had no comments or no issues with that, so therefore there's no issues with that. Next is the discretion over suspending students. As the code currently says, you must do something. We had asked to switch it to May. President Pollock had proposed, instead of just having a May with a footnote, it says now may suspend the offender or issue a lesser penalty. In the event that the JA suspend, the JA shall follow the procedures. Okay. So that is what she proposed. It's a small change. The other part, adding the offense, she had no comments on. So that is the second one.
I have a question about that. So in the box below that, is the box below that a different area, or is the box below that says? Yeah.
That's with this.
Okay. So I have a question about that. So when I was reading to refuse to comply with any valid penalty or remedy dispensed, I was wondering, is that defined anywhere? Like what a valid sort of remedy is? Because the language that you omit gives you an idea of what might be like a valid penalty or where that might come from.
Yes.
And I think without sort of somewhere, if it's going to be like in the hearing and review board rules or in the code somewhere else or anything else that defines sort of where penalties can come from, I think you might get some pushback on what valid is from respondents potentially.
Mm-hmm. The stricken language actually is a copy out of our Title IV, which is okay. Raise the public order. RAMPOs, its acronyms, pronouns. That one was very, that language I see might have many people in the community go abroad, which is why it was tightened down.
Okay.
The validity essence would be if the JA issues a no contact or the hearing board says you must complete community service, assuming procedurally it's intact, the procedural period of the file is valid.
Okay.
So it's not defined there, but it's almost, to the law, supposed to matter with it is the judgment, there's a limited judgment to enforce it.
Okay.
But we can certainly clarify that. I will make a note that valid may want some form of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, because I wondered about what if the JA, in an attempt to sort of do that, move towards that restorative justice model opposed to the penalty, that would be more novel. And if that would be something that would be considered valid within this particular form.
The code right now doesn't, the penalties enumerated in the code are relatively narrow.
Yeah.
Discretion in fines, description in combination. But the newer novel penalty, as opposed to currently written to my knowledge, isn't there. But if we're going to move in that direction, something definitely to be considered in that. If you were to say that could be a theory or hard to measure, mm-hmm. you don't want somebody inadvertently or otherwise prosecuted is the wrong word, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Under this provision. So but that's definitely something we'll note and we'll get into. Are there any other questions or comments on the non-compliance of sanctions portion? Hearing none. The next one is language for non-matriculated minors. So there's one change that's very minor, and then there's one change that's not so minor. The minor change is that President Pollock mirrored the language down to B, instead of, in essence, saying that if you're using the facilities or property, and you're also a non-matriculated minor, you'd also be excluded, which is an increase in the scope that was considered. So copying it is something that, again, how minor that is going to be off the side. But the other one that is a note is she has explicitly stricken the quote unquote, so long as individuals are subject to written behavior expectations, policies, or procedures, and it's the equivalent of a savings statute, meaning that if you, for any reason, don't have a policy on how you're going to behave, you fall back to the code. She removed that. However, as risk management said, A, that's very, very unlikely to happen, but in essence, it's a procedural safeguard because otherwise you will have people who are, in essence, subject to no expectations, which is one of the reasons the code was written in its current form, and there should always be something, whether that be if you're a proverbial 5-year-old soccer camp, it's what your parents received, and if or they didn't receive it, there needs to be something. That's something that was very heavily discussed by the committee, and I think we'll have to have a larger discussion about. Also, in her remarks, she mentioned, this was discussed briefly at her last meeting, she mentioned that she doesn't believe this committee should look at those policies at all. That's something that, and that's her, she's entitled to that opinion, but the committee for the UA rules, we're allowed to look at what things, we have discretion over our agenda and what we inquire as to, so that may be her preference. But if the committee chooses to say, I believe the bylaws, and bylaw change R5, explicitly lists that as somewhere that if it comes to us, we'll look at, and we discussed last meeting, if there's a need to just clarify that we don't expect this to happen frequently, ever, but it's important to us that, again, if we're putting someone, pulling someone out of the code, and if something goes off proverbial rails, again, that there's somewhere it can come to and we can go, oh, that's concerning, we'll pass a resolution. Because otherwise, it's going to, again, be in the ether where we'll never, we'll never get anywhere or see the proverbial sunshine. Are there any comments or questions on this?
I definitely agree with you that I think it's worth it to, I mean, obviously the risk management in those particular programs should have the first crack at subjecting their students or however they choose to define them, their participants to whatever types of rules I think are appropriate for that level. But I think it is appropriate for the code to sort of be a default. And if we sort of clarify that, like, in the unlikely event that they have no rules, then the code will cover them. But I think that should be in there from a procedural standpoint. I agree with you.
The administration give any reason why they would want these individuals not under the code?
Yes. That was discussed at the beginning, at the end of last term under the chairmanship of Mr. McBride. Risk management, in essence, came in and said, if you are, the way this is currently written, if you are, a student is defined incredibly broadly. So the example, the best example, is if I am a five-year-old doing a soccer camp on campus or doing a summer camp in whatever building, in theory, to remove you from that code, you have the full procedure of the code. You're entitled to the ACC, you're entitled to a hearing, you're entitled to the whole.
I'm just curious, why did President Pollack then remove the line about students who come to campus but are not under any other, so why would
that? In essence, that what that is that's a carve out. So, but not, I'm not speaking on her behalf because I am not her, but the way it's written, insofar as if you have a policy, you're carved out. If you don't have a policy, you're still under the code. Her language would say you're carved out regardless of a policy or not. In essence, you could be a group of 5-year-old soccer camp, and there's no behavior policy. With our language, you're back under the code. With her language, you're just, we didn't look that far. You're the policy. And risk management actually proposed having that as a, this is, we think it's important that everyone have something, and if it off chance we make an oversight, we can then do something. So again, it comes down to articulation. And they always talk a lot about her tone and the message, which I'm trying my best to pull out of that, because our goal is to be sure as reductive as possible. But that being said, tone, I mean, people are people. So that's really where it is there. Also, expanding into using facilities or property, that is, again, it's a slight expansion, but to me, it's because the question is, okay, what is a class? Is a summer camp, summer soccer camp a class? May or may not be, but you're using the facilities. And again, if it's in that area, I don't see an issue. The one thing the committee did bring up quite heavily was the Ithaca High School students who are taking classes here, but they go back to us, and they'll come up for one of their classes, and that was at Cornell. They are about as close to Cornell students as you can get them. Some of them are 18, actually they are not minors, they are 18. So they would be excluded from the code. Professor Lieberwitz had brought up an excellent point that, in essence, you're also connected from the free expression portions of the code. So if you are, I think, a high school student taking an introductory level biology or whatever class at Cornell, and you decide after to come back and protest, in theory, that you don't enjoy the same protection as the rest of the community. That was seen as a bit of a niche scenario, and apparently the guidelines for that are relatively stringent. That's also why there was the check in that, oh, if these high school students who are, for all intents and purposes, 9/10 of the way to being Cornell students are having issues, then they could come back to us and we could look at it. So if we're going to remove the saving and also our ability to look at it, I know that concern becomes, the Mr. Lieberts, not speaking our back, would likely say that's more of a salient concern. Richard.
So, I mean, they're borderline areas. So probably not important for us to worry too much about. But I was thinking alumni are like a one of them. So alumni have functions here. Mm-hmm. And we don't intend to cover them. But I think the thing that, I think the thing, it might be, not looking at this, and it would be terribly articulate, but not looking at this in the broader picture, when this high school students come up, they are in a relationship with faculty members. And being in a relationship with a faculty member means that it's not just the student who's in jurisdiction, but that relationship is in jurisdiction. And that, to me, that is what the campus code is about. The campus code is about the ethical and competent and whatever you want to call it, but regulation and oversight of faculty-student relations. So I would say that that's, to me, without that would be sort of a strong argument for pressing jurisdiction.
Absolutely, and, it's, and I should also clarify, we are free to say President Pollack, we've seen suggestions. For instance, maybe we choose to mirror it down to facilities, but leave in the other one, and we explain why. And it's worth, I mean, because the code is a two-way street. And I will note actually that saving statute, that saving clause, was written by the university itself. Risk management proposed it to us. So the same idea that certain aspects of, you came to us with a proposal, we agree, we accept the proposal. In essence, after we've gone through the whole motions, you are turning around and saying, oh, by the way, the safeguard, in essence, the compromise is being removed. Again, the president is free to do as she sees fit, but there's a certain aspect of it is a give and a take, and it's, we have to be somewhere in the middle. So obviously how we handle this is up to the committee. But I completely agree that since there's a, by removing certain aspects, you run the risk or modify them, you run the risk that there's knockdown effects, which is that I know I'm concerned about in my multi-year tenure on this committee. Everyone's always been very concerned about, okay, to make one small change, what is the unintended domino effect that might happen down the road? We've seen it happen before in some other areas, and we're trying to avoid it.
It was just, the campus code is supposed to be an ethical commitment to faculty-student relations, interpersonal relations, generally within the Cornell community. It is to carve out pieces of that and say it doesn't have jurisdiction. It doesn't, is to impair that. And that's, in the end, when we get around, I don't know when we're going to do this, but get around to revising the whole code, at the very beginning, that should be in the preamble.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, I mean, we were free to, I understand 100%. I agree that there's a large portion of it. I mean, we're free to even tweak this further. We could repass on it even further. And if you want to narrow the exclusion or widen it, this committee, again, she has asked and said, here's what I think you should do. We are free to say, sit there and say, we agree with you. I think, for instance, the last one where she simply clarified some language, that's actually, to me, the quintessential, it's a clarification. I don't see, personally, don't see much of an issue with it. Here, though, it's a more substantive recommendation. And the committee has in the past said, we see your recommendation. We have made following changes to our recommendation, but we're not, in essence proposing somewhere in the middle. Our interposition, your interposition, we need somewhere in the middle. If you accept it, it's in. If not, well, for the code, it wouldn't be. And I mean, again, the part is the administration requested this, so I would hope they would have some vested interest in seeing it through. But if we choose to take a different path than even we took in the fall, we are free to do that. We are in no way constrained. We can say, you know what, we don't even want this carpet and leave it as it is. That may have other repercussions, but we are really, truly free to do, and the committee is free to do as it sees fit. Is there anything else on this? I know, actually, after this, we're going to go through have more of how we're going to look at this, because we are at quorum just barely, to try and figure out how we want to exactly tweak language. Next on the list is, the removal and indefinite suspension. This one had no comments whatsoever, so that's an easy one. She supported it, and therefore, it's just a matter of recasting it. And then finally, the UHRB appointment process. This one was actually, I think there may have been a typographical error in it, but I'll give everyone a minute to look at it. But in essence, she's concerned that allowing reappointment, in essence, removes check and balance from the dean of faculty. She mentions the office assembly is having a check and balance. To be fair, in the code, the office assembly has no check and balance. They simply are logistics. This is something we've been very clear about. I presume it's a typo. Bluntly, I know the office does help write some of the response resolutions in the past, so that maybe it may have slipped through. But that being said, the dean of the faculty does make the initial nomination, and the renewal process is synced and said, in essence, the UJC reapproves you and the UA reapproves you. We'd like to have the dean of the faculty, in essence, my concern is the dean of the faculty, Dean Van Loan has been very good with doing this people. bribing the faculty have been not quite so good at getting us people, and we've been reappointable for many years. So an option that we could do is say, currently serving members may be appointed traditional terms, reconfirmed by the university assembly. After review by the co-judicial committee, faculty members will be removed, will be reviewed by the co-judicial committee, and with the dean of the faculty copied or otherwise essence, notify the dean of the faculty, but if there's no issues. Because part of it's, I don't want it. I'm concerned that if we send it to the faculty, and the faculty is busy, otherwise engaged, or not interested, which can't happen, has happened, that we're going to have some issue there. But I think that portion is certainly something we can do. And obviously, again, this is my opinion, the committee, we are free to go, you committee's free to go however they wish. But it's not, I mean, the dean of the faculty is the one concern there. And I'm happy to, we need to kind of correspond with Dean Van Lone, but the office assembly didn't say just for that, that the office does not have oversight over this process. They are, the coach just says they work with us in essence to have logistics. We can also clarify that language to receive it. So in essence, they said, my take is add something about the dean of the faculty. After we've done that, it should be good to go. And if there's no issues, what I could do is propose some form of an idea so that the next meeting the committee gets and say, here's something on paper. We agree, we disagree, we want to tweak it, just to frame our discussion instead of more generalities. Are there any questions on the interview itself? Okay, next.
If I have a question. So if we change this and approve this, like when would this go into effect? Would this affect our current cycle?
That's an excellent question. Our hope would to do it quick enough. As I said, we've done reappointments in the past. Right now, and I told the JA this, the code does not prohibit reappointments. It says it's silent. It's gray. And so in essence, it all it says is you apply, you're nominated, and the UA confirms you. In practice, it doesn't apply in time. We are, I would assert, it's a gray area. It should be fixed. It's being fixed. But we are free to follow what we've done before and say, okay, we've come up with some more formalized process in anticipation of this. We're going to follow this process. We intend to get it through. But we have some freedom to move around and say, okay, code doesn't say we can't do this. We're fixing the code, but we'll we're waiting for that. We're going to move forward.
Oh, I think Gabe had a question.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I can't find like the membership of the committee. I just want to count how many members.
There are.
It's not online.
It's not online. There are, I believe, 8 seated members.
Okay.
Just a quorum.
Okay.
But I will verify. Are we at 9? I could be wrong. I'd be at 9.
Even if we're 8, we don't have quorum.
Yeah, actually, no, we don't have quorum. Either way, it's not. We haven't taken any action, so we're having a discussion. Well, I will make sure the minutes are ready. We don't have quorum. I miscounted. I apologize. I was thinking we had 10 members and we have 11, and that's why we're actually correct. I apologize.
Okay.
Because we have 2 vacancies right now. Okay. I will clarify. Either way, I don't believe we have form now. We will sort it out. We're having a discussion. Unless there's a pressing issue.
The clerk does have a list of the current.
Oh, it's perfect.
I just wanted to look at it.
That's fantastic. We do have 3 vacancies. We have 8. I just got that. We don't have form. We're 1 short. Thank you for that clarification. I apologize for miscounting. It's funny because Dale, you asked me exactly how many people on the committee. I said, oh, here's all the seats. And I managed to somehow forget myself in that calculation. But so we don't have a quorum. That's fortunate because we're not getting any action. Anyways, but for the record, we need to reflect that the committee has not had quorum, and that is my oversight. Any other issues on the UHRB reappointment process? Next is J reappointment. This one is, this is President Essence said no. It's probably the best way to put it. This is an issue that the full UA is actually looking at because we have to determine how we're going to, if we're going to reappoint Michelle. So that is currently being addressed at a higher level. We do need to come up with a process eventually. I would imagine that might happen this year, it might happen next year, but this one I think will likely not be in this is because it is a larger issue, it's a separate issue. And by reappointing Jay, you are buying yourself some time, whether that's 1 year, 2 years, or because it was served unfortunately, we may have to do that. But as if we have some time there. Okay, I don't think, are there any questions or comments on that? Okay, and the last one is
just a bigger time. So this will come up in the UA next week.
The GA reappointment? Yeah, we're going to discuss that next week. The exec committee. Yes, the UA exec committee has a meeting with the president scheduled for Tuesday.
Before the meeting, correct?
Yeah, before the meeting. yeah, we reach out to her about that.
Excellent. Thank you very much for looking forward to this. Anything else on the JA reappointment, which is still ongoing, but not necessarily here? Okay. Which is just the last point, which is the discretion and no contact directives. The president had no concerns, wanted us to ask, talk to complainants advisors about this. Coincidentally, I have it formally. We will certainly solicit their formal feedback, and if it has changed, we will accommodate it. As I mentioned before, the JA has already been acting under this, and technically the complaints advisors actually would never interact. Even the complaints would technically never interact with this because they're under 6.4 to follow a different no contact policy. That being said, they have a valid point of view, and I'm more than happy to hear from them. So the president asked for that, and the president also the new right of appeal, and that the she also said by its nature intended to be interim, so we don't know if we need appeals. I personally want to provide some context. This was brought to our attention 4 years ago by the former judicial codes counselor Dominicus, who in essence said that people were interim suspended or interim contracted for 6 months plus. So in a perfect world, this being used for a week or two. The president is absolutely correct. There is no need for a right of appeal. And I will personally clarify that in most situations, I would have to need this, which is also, I believe, why it says maybe 21 days. So that's if it's suspended after the appeal vanishes, then we can tweak language. But this has been in the past used for things that I think many would consider not interim, and therefore having a right of appeal, I would argue, is a prudent course of action. That being said, the committee is free to do it. I think it's also an area where we can provide more context and say, we were informed by the JCC there are multiple issues where this happened. Therefore, we think we're going to fix this and something we put in there. That means that that's something obviously we don't have to decide again.
There was something that I actually wanted to bring up before, but I think I forgot to raise my hand. Regarding the hearing boards, so that we want to include an explicit provision for removal from the hearing boards.
Actually, thank you for reminding me. Yes.
Because that became a problem.
Thank you for reminding me. That was actually on that one, Mike. And I was going to say other things that come up. In a meeting with the JA, in essence, removing someone from the hearing boards is, in essence, we're missing an S in one of the areas. It says the hearing board chair may remove members. Back in the day, there was only one chair. There are now five chairs. So it's a question of interpretation. I think since I would agree, it's an easy fix. I mean, thank you for reminding me. I don't write a note.
Yeah.
I do have other notes from that meeting that I will bring forward. There's also something that was brought up, and that should be clarified by the office assemblies, because the president's response seems to intend they have an oversight role. Code does not give them one. They do not have one. To ensure that there is no confusion as to the role of the office, we could also consider tweaking language. I think a prior version even had that. That's something we can certainly consider if we need to. Richard?
So Dave, what's the case? The
case?
The instance that you were citing that you did removed?
Someone who has responded to any emails whatsoever. So there's a board member who just has gone down, preferably gone dark. Will not respond to emails. We can't get a hold of them.
Yeah, so like some people, the office of the judicial administrator will like reach out and say like, hey, time to do your training. And then will not respond, maybe because it's already on their resume and they don't want to do any work for it. You know, God knows why. And so in cases like that, it would be helpful to basically be able to say, like, if you don't respond, we will put someone who will respond in, because there were a couple people where they were having that issue, and they were like, we can't remove them. They're kind of stuck.
As I discussed with the JA, there's a way to read it so I can remove them. I don't believe it's a stretch. In essence, it's just saying, the code says, rough quote, the hearing board chair may remove members of the boards who do not honor their commitments via attendance or otherwise. This is an attendance issue. Again, if there was once a single hearing board chair, there are now five. To me, it's not a stretch to say, okay, this is an S we need to add. Again, I think we're going to do it. So I don't think it's that big of an issue. I don't think it's a stretch. But either way,
let's just add something.
I completely agree. Well, for in the area, we might as well.
And just get longer instead of shorter.
All right.
On page 8, dealing with this, no contact.
Yes.
I'm trying to understand. So there wasn't in the code as it stands now. There is no grounds for appeal? There's no procedure?
For an interim, so in essence, this is regarding interim actions. So in essence, if you are, and I actually clarified, for interim suspensions, or interim
meaning between the time of the charge and his disposition.
That is correct.
Okay.
Or actually, it's generally, my understanding is it can be even shorter. It could be between the time of the charge and the time the hearing board is able to get together and examine the interim measures. And the concern that we had had was there have been instances where people were subject to no interim directives going on 6 months plus. And personally, I don't believe that cuts an interim anymore. And they were unappealable. So in essence, you think, oh, this is done, or it's still ongoing. But that's where we're going. So. Yes, and that was the concern that was raised to us by the Judicial Codes Counselor back in 2014. And it's been languishing through, but that's why we included it here, because there have been issues. I've been told that our current judicial administrator has had no issues, which is excellent. That being said, being aware that there was one point on issue, it seems to my station prudent to say, well, if it ever happens again, we're gonna make sure you're right on appeal.
What exactly is a no contact?
Sequel number restraining order. I can't go with an execution.
Well, it's more like a temporary restraining order.
Yes,
a TRO. That's the idea.
Yes.
Or in practice, was
it means that you can't
talking.
Pretty much, you can't go to 20 feet. What they might do also is say, okay, your internal conduct order. If there's two people, they'll say, okay, you will follow this route to class. You will follow that route to class. It'll put rules on there. The reason we're making mutual is there are also instances where one party would have a no contact order, it was not binding on the other party, and the other party would antagonistically, intentionally break the no contact order to get the other person temporarily suspended. Which is also why we're at
it. I understand why you make it neutral, but I'm trying to understand why anybody would appeal.
If it's going on for 6 months and the case hasn't been disposed of.
Then they just have contact with this other person. So.
Well, it can, depending on what kind of order it is, it can materially affect your ability to move around campus and engage in the activities that you would as a normal student.
Yeah.
No, that's the issue, is where the not timely disposition of the case interferes with the person's
life.
And it might be innocent, but.
A no contact director also kind of an issue that if there is only a single section of a class offered, And it's not a 500-person lecture.
But you know, appealing isn't.
Appealing, in effect,
is a disposition of the case.
It would just dispose of the contact directive. It
doesn't
pass on the merits of the case.
Prejudging the case.
In essence, the way no contact directives work is they are seen as an extraordinary remedy, in essence, that there is an imminent or urgent risk that therefore we cannot wait for a due process procedure. We're gonna say, because this is so urgent and such an emergency, we're going to say you can't do this until then. And therefore, as the hearing boards would convene and say, is there an imminent threat? If no, the no contact directive is no longer should be there.
So the idea is that just because an order was granted, that doesn't say anything about what's going to happen in the procedure after they talk about the interim no contact directive. So just because one was granted doesn't mean it has any bearing on that particular person's case before the hearing of a review board. So I don't, as far as I'm concerned, I'm assuming that it's similar, but you can't consider the fact that a no contact directive was issued in the actual sort of case when people are sort of giving their evidence.
Nah, I buy that. That's completely accepted. But if you appeal and the restraining order is lifted, that looks like a predisposition.
No.
Anyway, here's a suggestion.
Okay.
Rather than have an appeal, why don't you just say that after, I don't know, 3 months, 2 months, some reasonable time, that the restraining order basically has a time limit on it. I mean, because that looks like the issue. I mean,
we used to have like language in there. Didn't we like propose language at some point where it was like
we proposed language, if I recall correctly, to limit how no contact directives were utilized. The president was concerned that we're limiting the JA's discretion, and that there are some scenarios where an interim directive may need to go on for an extended period. And therefore,
with like a 3-week limit, right? So a 3-week limit and like renewable for 10 days.
Yes, actually, I remember we had done that. So it's 3 weeks, it automatically gets renewed, you have to go to the hearing board. That would seem onerous, and there may be a legitimate reason. And therefore, in essence, the idea was okay. And again, we can certainly go back to that if we think we need to. But the no contact directive has a higher bar. In essence, it has to be something that's so imminent that we don't have time to really figure out if it's true or not without sounding hyperbolic. In essence, like, oh, if JJ has some evidence to believe that John Doe is going to physically injure John Smith, the DOJ will likely issue an immediate no contact directive in an effort to ensure that no one gets hurt.
So we could put in here that after, say, 3 weeks, the judicial administrator may have the authority to revise the no contact
directive. The DOJ has the authority to revise the no contact directive. No contact directive at any time.
Oh, well then this is a moot issue.
Well, the thing is that the issue in the BCMP you've seen in the past is, in theory, it should be a moot issue. In theory, a no contact directive should be for 2 weeks or until we get a hearing board. The problem is there were hearings that were going on in 6 months plus, and the no contact directive was precluding people from going to classes.
But the JA could lift.
Yes, but the JA would lift
the onerous parts.
Yes, but the JA refused to lift the onerous parts.
Oh, well, that conversation with the JA rather than.
We're trying to give people another remedy in case that.
Yes, in essence, the JA says, no, I don't think it's onerous. So in essence, instead of being you're out of luck, the idea is to have the hearing board sit there and go, okay.
The problem is, if this is delays for the hearing board and the appeals are going to the hearing board, then the hearing board is going to be even slower during this decision.
Well, so the delays were not because of the hearing board, the delays are because of production of witnesses, my understanding. Was production of witness, production of evidence. So since the hearing board was standing by, but for whatever reason, the hearing was being delayed due to extraneous circumstances. So in essence, almost imagining two parallel tracks, the full hearing on the merits can take a couple of days, and the no contract directives are meant to be an emergency action of, we are not saying you're innocent or guilty, but to sort everything out, we're going to, in essence, stay away from each other. The problem is, there is record, and I was informed, there were times to go on 6 months, and it was onerous.
Show here to explain why.
Well, she was not the one who did this, thankfully. She did not do this. It was one of her predecessors who did those actions, which is why this language was proposed back when it was.
So she's not an issue, then.
Michelle had no issue. President Pollack said, I don't know why you need one. And that's why I was going to say we can explain why we need one. And so, I can cite to say we received information that's credible in X year and X day from X party. This happened. We don't think it will happen again, but in the event it does, we're creating a procedural safeguard. It's the same reason the JA has what's called an order to show cause. If the JA refuses to take your case, so to speak, you can force the JA to provide rationale to the hearing board why they didn't take it, and the hearing board can compel the JA to take the case. The same idea here is the JA can and does unilaterally impose an interim no contact directive. In essence, this provides a check. So if the JA makes a mistake or is otherwise not willing to do or change something, you can go to a third party, the hearing boards, and the hearing board will then make a decision, and that will in essence allow for oversight and a check and a balance. Yeah?
I don't have a few thoughts and questions. How often has this, I don't know, this is an answer, how often this has happened where no contact directives have gone on for so long that they've become this problematic? And my problem with this language is that I don't know if it would happen, but it seems like the person can appeal an indefinite number of times. So let's say they are in one of those situations where the no contact directive is going on for 6 months or a year or however long. They can appeal, the board could say, no, we're not lifting it. They could appeal again, and I feel like that could waste the board's time. Like there's no definite, like I feel like there should be a reset time. Like if your appeal is rejected, then it should have, at the very least that language is gonna go in, there should be an amount of time before they can reappeal.
Absolutely, I can provide the answer. If I recall correctly, I was told in at least three instances in a 1 or 2 year span where this happened. Again, it's only three people, but to me, it's also looking at, again, these people are not innocent, or these people are not responsible, they're not innocent or guilty. There's been no determination of the merits. It's just, we are accused, and we're going to do this and turn it upside down. Again, I recognize, and I think everyone recognizes, there are times where you need to move quickly to ensure that no one gets hurt and everything stays okay. But the concern is, it's waiting for 6 months. Why? The urgency is clearly not there because you wouldn't have the hearing already. And in terms of the appeal, the process above it is the appeal process for generally, and if I recall correctly, it has, if you appeal, in essence, in order to appeal again, you have to have had a material change, whether that be a substantial passage of time. Like, okay, I appealed 2 weeks in, and it's now a year later. Yes, you could reappeal. Or some other changing. Okay, more evidence came to light. So that's, I will check that, though.
And then would it be the same UHB that is currently or will be here in the case that would hear?
It would be a separate.
So different board. And
that could honestly, you might see an electronic board. In essence, they'll Skype in and they'll have a meeting because it's just them say the J would say, here's why I issued it. The bar would be listed. And I believe the JCC would also, I'm not sure how, you'd be able to submit it. There would be there. Submit a submission. I think you probably could be there and say, here's why we think the no contract directive is not required. J would say why it is required. The bar of proof would be read. And the hearing board would then deliberate and say, okay, is there an imminent or urgent threat that this is necessary considering we have a hearing? If yes, they hold. If no, they tell the JA you can't, or they can modify it too and say, okay, the restriction that you must do X is onerous. We're going to change it to Y or remove just that restriction.
And then the last question is, why do people go 6 months before a UHB trial?
That's a wonderful question. It's one that I asked myself when I heard this. And what I was told is that there are times where due to not the boards themselves, but due to availability of witnesses, due to written submissions, due to it going on over an academic break or other areas, the timeline can get extended. I'm not sure. In the cases I was told were very generalities because of the rules that they're confidential. But in essence, it would be availability of witnesses, or what happened, I believe, once, because they couldn't get the hearing board all physically there. And for instance, for the hearing board has to be there. For something like an appeal like this, it could be electronic because you're just hearing one small thing and going, okay, is this urgent? Michelle would be an excellent person to have here, but that is why we looked at it. And this mirrors the appeals process for general interim measures. It just has a longer bar because it has a slightly lower.
I'm still giving it to the hearing board for an appeal. Mm-hmm. Looks like to me, if they're going to do their job correctly, it's going to be on the merits. They're going to be, you know, how likely is contact or modification of the no contact directive likely to result in harm? And that's going to be a review, and it's got to be a review of the case. They're not going to be able to hold that. It seems to me that the JA is a much better person to negotiate, massage, and tweak the no contact directive than the hearing board.
The JA currently has that ability. B, the JA would still have that. I understand what you're saying. The JA would still have that ability. This is essence of saying that if I'm the party and I say to the JA, this is not necessary, and the JA says, I disagree, I'm not going to change anything. In essence, the way it is right now is until you get a hearing, you're stuck. The JA is not going to change his or her mind about how the no contact directive should be written or enforced. You are stuck with it until you have a hearing on the merits. This is in essence.
Yeah, I think the JA says you're stuck with it, you're stuck with it. What do you think?
Generally, like, if you have a sort of interim measure and like for like legal, like in the law, when you have something like the closest thing to this would be considered a temporary restraining order. But generally, temporary means you sort of balance the equities of, okay, well, if everything that the JA or the respondent in this case says is true, if you take that as true, and this harm would result, you sort of balance the equities and sort of say, is it in the public interest to grant this temporary restraining order so that nothing else can happen? So that's how it works in the legal sort of realm.
I understand.
That's not really where we are. And right. The issue is that sort of in the legal realm, interim can mean a much longer period of time. Here, there's no reason for interim to mean 6 months. And the reason why, so Matt's saying that the JA can revisit this if they want to, but what he's saying is that sometimes the JA will say no, and that there is going to be other sort of procedural delays. Can you get witnesses? Can you get evidence? Can you get your submissions that are no fault of any of the parties? But this is still a pretty onerous burden that's supposed to be for a very short amount of time and in very extraordinary circumstances. So if the JA decides, you know what, I don't want to modify this because of whatever reasons they have, which might be a perfectly valid reason, that doesn't necessarily mean that this isn't still an overly onerous burden to whoever it's imposed upon or if it's mutually imposed. So this gives another sort of route of, another way to sort of cure this issue. Like if you go to the JA and you negotiate with them and say like, hey, like this is why I don't think this is necessary, and the JA just doesn't buy it, doesn't want to do it, whatever reason, this gives you another chance.
Yeah, you can multiply that endlessly, right? You could appeal from the university.
Well, it sounds like...
The for 3 months, and then the JA or the University Hearing Board has to renew it. Then you don't. Then the appeal is on. The appeal is automatic, which I think is kind of nice, because then they got something in front of them that says, "Hey, we're slow on this." Rather,
we tried that.
The issue is not just that it's slow. The issue is that it's sort of not fact specific. So someone might say, you know what, I need to take one more class to graduate, and I'm not going to be able to register for it within this 3 month period. So you want them to have a chance to sort of have an ability to have someone hear what they have to say and sort of feel like you're being heard, instead of sort of having to wait for 3 months. Okay, now I can't graduate in the spring. Now I have to graduate in the fall, you know? So you want to be able to be sensitive to those situations where you might have to reassess something a little bit earlier than might be convenient.
Also, for the record, no contact orders can, interim, no contact orders can and are issued ex parte. For instance, you only one person has talked to the JA, and JA can act.
Yeah, I think we're going to just talk to JA.
I will say for the record, we have had instances where the JA's conduct was scrutinized after the fact, and there was concerns about it. In essence, the reason we're doing this is that the JA right now can say, "Oh, the case is, I'm so concerned, we're going to, no contact order, I'm not going to change it, goodbye." And this is, it's a premonition until you get done with it. Yeah.
Yeah, so like, I know that, you know, you usually agree with the actions of the JA, and like, historically you've been a proponent of supporting what the JA does, but like, surely some times.
With one exception.
Right. Surely sometimes the JA will make a mistake engaging whether the public interest is actually really harmed by keeping someone going to classes. Right. And so I don't know. I think that there should be more.
It sounds to me like that the real injustice is the delay in the decision. That's the real injustice. And I don't like the idea of massaging no contact orders, because this injustice making a decision has occurred. I like things to be very straight, and I like to throw things in the lap of people who, if they are, Matt says they're not at fault because they're waiting for witnesses and so forth. But I still like it to be in the lap of the hearing board. I have to put a time limit on this. And then if you want the hearing board to hear appeals, have them be automatic and go to the hearing board. And have the hearing board explain to somebody why there's a delay, which actually I think is something that should be done here too. And this is something where we're imagining that they have good reasons, but they may not.
Absolutely. So Adele and Victoria, just to clarify, TJC, I want to say 3 years ago, when we were first looking at this issue, the language that was considered, and I believe passed in essence, said no contact directives have a maximum duration of, I think maybe it was 21 or 28 days, 4 weeks. After which the hearing boards, as of the day, has to go back to the hearing board and ask the hearing board to reimpose it. The president's response, if I recall, I can list the exact one, was the concerns of the owners and the hearing boards, and that there may be issues where, in essence, if the no contact order is justified, the interim one, then we're forcing appeals where they may not be needed, and it creates, in essence, a presumption that you have to keep doing this. And there, the president wasn't the most pleased with it. Therefore, we said, okay, if we can't do that, we'll offer a right of appeal that it only kicks in after 21 days. So, if there's no contact directive is less than 21 days, you can't appeal it because, in essence, again, a 21-day delay is not seen as so onerous. But after it's been 21 days, you can tell the hearing, you can ask the hearing board to look at it and go, is it truly urgent enough to still continue? So that's why we did it. Obviously, we have to change direction.
The hearing board officer is going to show up for the UA soon.
The hearing board chairs are hoping for the beginning of March. Yes, seven here.
So then this would be a good thing. This would be a good thing to talk to them about. Because
Dale and Victoria.
I was going to say that I agree that a 3 month time delay before it expires or needs to be renewed by a hearing board that didn't go the first time is a lot different than 3 weeks. I mean, 3 months is pretty much the length of a semester. Anytime, like if it expires after 3 months, it's going to be before the start of next semester, regardless of when it's given. And that
That, I feel like, is a lot less onerous on the JA and any hearing boards that would have to hear it. I feel like it's very fair to the student. If it's given during one semester, if you don't have your case before the next semester, you're going to have your contact order reviewed before the beginning of the next semester. And I feel like if they weren't okay with 3 weeks, they might still be okay with 3 months.
I mean, I think pretty much everything has been said, but like, I think the issue is that not necessarily that there would be a particularly long delay, but that interim isn't defined. So I think it's worth having an appeals process because we're not sticking a sort of very formulaic definition on interim. But I think we can revisit that.
We absolutely can. Yeah, and that's exactly why we're having this discussion for that. We tried to do this before, it didn't go through. We tried to prove this, the president was concerned. It's a give and a take. And the concern was, and I think the one that I think we're articulating is that there are scenarios where, for whatever reason, an interim measure is used for a period that is longer than it needs to be. In essence, the interim measures, they're meant to be as light touch as possible, but then afterwards you have a hearing on the merits of what you should do, if anything.
So when the hearing board folks come to us, could we request information from them on the disposition of cases?
How long it takes? It's all public. That is all public record. We can get that. Yes.
So let's get that.
So I would say Michelle, the current JA, has gotten the number down quite a bit. It used to be, and it's on the front page of the Daily Sun, that we were looking at 90 to 180 days to dispose of a case with the prior JA. I believe we're down to an average of around 30 to 60, which, think about it, it's much, much, much less considering all the parks around. So we have gotten better. But when Michelle came here, she was in the middle of the discussion, and I remember sitting down and explaining to her, it's not that we don't trust you, it's we're concerned about who will hold the role in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years.
That's a valid concern, but I'm not quite sure how the process works. I want to know about the real outliers. I can imagine an outlier going on for 2 years if there's witnesses or other things. That looks really close to me.
I completely agree.
So let's get real data, and then we can talk, in the abstract about details. We can talk about cases that are outliers and why they happen.
We can also ask for an example of what an interim contact record looks like.
Yeah, I think that's good. Victoria's probably right.
It's something we can discuss and kind of like talk about, but like, yeah.
And just, that's it.
I mean, this is what we should be doing with the hearing boards anyway.
We'll get a copy. My understanding is it can also extend to, you can't interact online. I mean, the conditions can be quite severe. And because of that, that's also one of the reasons that it's, if you're following, and they also can be so severe that you can't go to clubs. So as it's, you may enter campus at X time, you must leave campus at X time, and that was part of the reason they were seen as onerous. But we will have that, I will ask for that information. An interim, I would imagine there's like a template interim document, which I'm sure we'll get. And then I will be sure to bring it up to the hearing board chairs. I don't forget, I'll write it down. Fantastic. So that exhausts that. I think we're actually running out of time for two. Which leads us to the next issue, our next item on the agenda, which is R5, which is really, there's a lot of fluff, a lot of procedural. What it's doing is it adds three items to the bylaws of the University Assembly in guarding laws, recording areas that this committee has historically looked at, and two of them we've historically looked at, and one that, like, non-retributed providers in our governing documents for the purpose of recording them so they're not forgotten. To be very clear, these are issues that I expect will come up infrequently. 6.4 may come up frequently. Actually, I think all of them, 6.4 is likely to come up most frequently. A fire safety guidance for 1 through 15 years. And non-treated minors, they never come up. But it's recording them because, for instance, a lot of people don't know at the UA and all the assembly, they vote 6.4. When I found out that we have oversight over the fire safety and lighting declaration guidelines, and the non-treated minor is response to our current code changes. But the goal here is to institutionalize the memory of it, because I graduated in 2019, so I'm very after 2019, I will no longer be involved in the assemblies. And if my successor doesn't know that, they're not going to be able to understand and know about it. I mean, I first heard about the quality lighting policy when I received an email from a reporter about it, which is very interesting. So it's important to have it documented. And that's really what this is doing. It's just adding these three areas to bylaws and saying, here's what we need. And as it ever comes up, or if you don't even know we have this authority, be aware of it.
If we had a forum, we just say,
we could just have it, yes.
Yeah. And then I would go back to UA and then we do.
Yeah.
But we don't have a forum, so we can't do that.
Point of information.
Yes.
Does the UA bylaws, do those need presidential approval?
It needs to be an automatic one. So we've got bylaws to amend them, has to be for, as in say it went to the UA, it can't be run on that meeting. Next meeting, as long as it's approved by a majority of the seated membership, it has immediate effect. And also the 6.4 portion also relates to, there's the intrigue language, relates to the complainant's advisor, which we've been working with recently, and actually I may even maybe just note that if we're going to be tweaking it. But as it's the same idea, we pass the resolution of support through the UA to change the charter, so the complainant's advisors are confirmed in the same manner as the ACCs to increase their visibility and to ensure that they are, as to try and put them on equal footing, and it would make sense that that would also fall under us because 6.4's carve-out is from code, and code has a whole bunch of baggage there, which, there's a size to say it's a lot. Are there any questions or other comments on that? And next is a hearing board staffing updates. I work with the office assemblies in the fall to get a timeline. I believe the application should have opened already, so I'm going to follow up and ask what is, it's either this week or next week, so it's either coming up, in which case I'll talk to make sure it's okay, or it was passed, and or has passed, in which case we need to figure this way out. But our goal is to have this done sooner rather than later instead of waiting until May. And we are moving forward. We had one question that says, please explain anything else you want to explain. 350 words, which can be proven. I don't know if we will try it. It works great. If not, we get rid of it. Our hope is to have it done soon. There is also talk that depending on how many vacancies we have, we'll reach out and see who wants to renew. Calculate the number of vacancies. If we have enough, we have 5 vacancies and 10 people who receive top marks as qualified, we have the right we can use interviews. We've done it in the past, we've done it a number of years because we were always doing it respectfully by the skin of our teeth. Getting it done right in the last meeting. But if we're moving schedule, which is our goal, we should be able to do that, hopefully. So, any comments or questions regarding the hearing board staffing?
Not hearing board staffing, but everything that where the president had no objections, those are passed.
Right? No, they're not. The code amendments contained a non-severability clause. And that was done because in the past, the president, and I don't mean this is not this president, but in the past, what the UA would do is they'd pass 4 code amendments. The president would accept 2 of them. And since there'd be 2, this forum commands, two of which the president wants, 2 which the UA wants, the president would accept their own amendments and ignore ours.
Got it.
But therefore, we put a non, therefore, we voice our non-severability that it's.
So, got it. So, I'm not sure that's the way to go with this, though. I mean, I'm not sure.
Well, the concern we had before was there are some changes that the administration would be more likely to favor, which are the ones they proposed, versus the ones we proposed, which may or may not be liked. And therefore, that's why. And so the goal is to force discussion. Instead of the president going, I accept 3 and 5, and the rest can go away. This forces the president to talk to us.
I take that back. We have stakes in what they hear. So that's.
But that's why, but that's, I mean, the ones that have no comment, I presume if we repass them, there will be the proverbial ones that just go right through.
There is no two-thirds override, though, if we, the president rejects them, so.
Mm-hmm. We are.
We have to negotiate with us. You could just be like, I will approve nothing unless you give me these things.
You could. That would, I mean, that's, yeah, that would be concerned that happened. Yeah. There are other mechanisms we can do to bring that up. It has never happened, but which is fortunate.
I have faith that the president will do that.
Yes, do I. And the UA can do the exact same as well, but I haven't heard that either. That being said, the next and the last item.
Don't put it in the minutes.
I have faith she won't do it.
That's excellent. And then he shook his head. Anyway, the last item of business is our policy 6.4, which is mentioned in R5, it's mentioned all over the place. In essence, this promotes primarily the complaints advisor, as you may or may not have just talked about this very briefly at the beginning of the year. The Department of Education rescinded the former Dear Colleague letter that caused the Cornell to lower the quantum proof on 6.4 cases by removing it from the code 2 preponderance from clear convincing. There's there's new guidance which says that you may need to be raised. That is being handled by legal counsel, to my knowledge, and we can discuss that if the committee wishes to. But the reason this is primarily here is complaints advisor, because we've been trying to work with them. We have been working with them, asking for charge change of support, and knowing that 6.4 is, for lack of a better word, radioactive plutonium. That that's an area that this committee is very able to work in a positive manner. And unless there's a consensus, we want to look more at the plutonium area, we certainly can't. But in terms of complaints advisors, where I think we can have a positive impact, there was talk previously of backing them into the code of conduct when they're also on the drawing board. Because in essence, they will serve for your complaints advisor for 6.4 cases. But in cases where there is, the complaint is not the universal essence, in the JA process, there are two groups of complainants. There is, I believe that John Doe assaulted me, so I am the complainant, and I have to go to the, and I file a charge to JA, and I move forward. Then there's one where the university is the complainant, the university acts as the state. And the JA is trying to get out of this role, but in those areas, the JA is more or less the prosecutor. The university, if they're really an administrator or whatever, says, John Doe, you have stolen something, assaulted someone, public urination, whatever it may be, and we are now for taking this charge against you. The idea was, in those areas, the JA is more than capable of representing the university, or the university can represent itself, be a council officer, or be a whoever, the administration. The concern was, if I am the person who was assaulted, and I made a simple assault, a punch in the face, or stole, or robbed, then you have no procedural advocate, but the accused always gets the JCC. And the idea was, well, if we're going to have this complaints advisor in 6.4, for cases where an individual is a complainant, it may make prudent, it may make sense to have them in the code as well. Obviously, the question, of course, is resources in other areas, but it's something that's been brought up in the past and something that I think is a good way to move. Is we're looking at ways to, when 6.4 was pulled, when the UA voted to remove sexual assault from the code, the intent was to try, as much as is legally possible, to use the policies, knowing that they're really, it's all about pursuing one standard of community conduct, which is why the code still has it. So that technically, by the code to do in there 6.4, it's just, in essence, 6.4, the code has said, we're not going to, enforcement is under this area. So you still violate the code when you do something that's improper. So that's what we're looking at. We're hoping to have the complaints advisor give us a brief chat on that, but we can do more.
When we do that, can we get the text?
Absolutely.
It's online.
Yeah, but I sort of,
yeah. No.
You know,
what's long.
Absolutely, we certainly can get the text down.
Question concerning the amendments to the code. I know that there was some, multiple people were upset that you didn't allow enough time for public comment. I was curious, where are those guidelines for public comment for code amendments?
They made them up.
So this is based on perceived precedent?
Right. There is really no precedent. And I think the last code change we did was except in the outer space working group recommendations, which were done by a publicly staffed committee that had like 80 assembly members on it. It was chaired by the former chair of the UA, Jim Blair. That was the last code change that the assembly passed. Prior to that, what we traditionally do is we'll open something up for public comment for however many days. Our bylaws didn't say that we have discretion in that area. With these, once we have, and I did ask Gina at the time, and I will actually make a note, remind me to ask again. This is on the assembly's website. We can open it for comment now if someone wants to comment. Realistically, historically, we'll have. But it's part of it. If we want to be more transparent, I am more than happy to comment on this. That being said, with the caveat that this is under active discussion, so you make comments on that we already changed or that we discussed and said, oh, we're going to, even with the no connectors, we're going to pivot off that. The comment on that area would likely be old, but still valuable. So that's what we're going to be trying to do with having this more outreach. And I'm also planning to stop by the ESA, the GPSA, the EA, and probably the Faculty Senate to say, here's what we're doing. Are there any questions? I mean, some of these things are incredibly minor. People put them to sleep. Other things are not so minor. I'm sure people have feedback. And Victoria.
Okay. Didn't Jeremy say something last week about maybe codifying what we consider to be public comment period in some kind of standing rule?
Absolutely.
Can we do that?
We certainly
can. I think we should do that.
Yeah, do too. And maybe something specific for the campus code of conduct as well. Are you talking generally about any UA resolution?
We're talking about, the UA can do standing rules wherever it sees fit. We can do them up for just with the CJC handles. The public comment is most salient with the code of conduct because it's the document that affects quite honestly everyone on this campus with potentially a small tip to note from non-treated minors. Because of that, it's the public comment, I think, is most, I mean, obviously everything we do is important, but that's the area where it's most salient. So we had talked about bylaws and appendix to the bylaws or somewhere, because I have scattered documents for the CDC going back to the mid-90s. And it's amazing how many things we talk about. This is a great idea. Let's do it. And then the chair leaves 2 years later, and everyone probably forgets about it, which is also why part of the reason I wrote R5, thinking, okay, knowing that we all leave eventually, unless you're the faculty are the longest. Pardon?
Or you.
Oh, thank you. But either way, things get lost, and that's the goal. So we put that, I would say, put it in the bylaws, put it somewhere that you can't lose, versus an ethereal, even an internal document, I would bet money it would be lost. So stapling it somewhere else, is people like, oh, does this really belong in the bylaws or standing rules? Maybe not, but at least there I know it's not going to get lost, which is the sad reality of that. Those documents don't get lost because they're maintained by the university because they are our roadmap, whereas an internal document will get lost as soon as I leave and everyone else forgets about it or leaves.
Are we going to revise the campus code of conduct?
That's a wonderful question. That was the intent of the year. Looking at where we are, we're going to start it. There's, with the JA reappointment process, anything else going on, there's a lot going on. There's some stuff also we can talk about privately that's unfortunately under my attention. So the goal is to do it, yes. Will it, when it will happen, is a bit more of an open question considering some other changes, because with the JA reappointment, we need to figure out what's going on with that. We need to figure out what this committee is, how we're going to handle it. The goal is to do it.
You have a 1 or a 2 year term on the UA? let's see. This is my third year in faculty senate.
Okay.
So that my department, I'll be reappointed to my that may be another 3 years. But the.
You've got time.
No. It's a real question about turnover.
Yeah, representation.
Right? Yeah, 3 years is a fair chunk of time. But as I understand my appointment from Charlotte to here to the UA, that is 1 year at a time.
It's 2 years.
Is it 2 years?
Unless I know we change it. Traditionally, faculty and staff got 2 year appointments to the UA. Points to the UA. Students are 1 year appointments because the turnover is much shorter.
So if it's 2 years and my department agrees to extend me to the faculty senate, then I'd be here next year.
Then you might be here when the code gets changed.
I mean, I completely agree that there are, and this is part of the reason I remember what I think may be a prudent course of action to go. And I know people were concerned about it, but I personally think piecemeal might be the better approach because it helps prevent the issues with turnover. And if you look at the first, you can't look at complete isolation. By looking at more targeted areas, it gives us more less to bite off. And I always look at even the HH working group, the false starts we have that.
It's just an observation. And from the beginning of last semester, we're over halfway through, we haven't done very much. I think trying to set a goal for doing something this semester would be a good idea, first article or whatever it might be. What you're suggesting is a modification of Michelle's membership. Let's have some committees and then come back to. But if we're going to do a piecemeal, I kind of think piecemeal is the right way to go. We're just going to be, think about this as so we avoid problems of interdependency between the different pieces.
And that's what I've been kicking this around because I was cognizant of the fact that it's already February and we all verbally turn the pumpkins May 31. Realistic things earlier than that. So the I completely agree. The goal is to try and find a way to make it manageable.
You're a pumpkin, right?
Isn't like I'm leaving?
Yeah.
Oh, bye bye.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Matt, you're a pumpkin.
I'm 2019, so I'm just dying someone.
Oh, so you have a year.
I graduate this year.
And you're a pumpkin.
Yep.
So, I mean, you're going to get turnover.
Well, that's an excellent point. That's something that we're, that's why I'm thinking the best way is to try and figure out some way to fit. There was another option that we had that was discussed. I was looking at feasibility was first, and this I think could be done this semester. Right now, the code is really disorganized. At first, to just organize the darn thing, put all the offenses together, put everything together. The exception of Rambo, because that's the trustees level one. Right, since Title IV is that requires trustees, and so that is there because it's required by New York State law. The exception of that one, to go through the code, in essence, break it up into its own pieces, and then arrange it in a way that's more manageable. You know, a lot of the problem with the code is that offenses are on five different pages, they're in five different areas, and they just, to the very least, try and do that, so we at least have a better idea, we can say, okay, now that we've organized everything, the interdependencies are removed, and we can start going through more piecemeal.
I buy that, just who's going to do it?
That would likely be me.
Yeah.
At least, I mean, the same way we did with the code changes, as it's, I would go through and say, here's a rough idea of what I'm thinking. Does the committee agree? And if so, we move forward. If not, we redo it or get rid of it or have someone else do it.
Okay. But we should, I mean, it's more work for you. It is more work.
If you want, I can take a look at that.
Actually, no, I'd be happy to chat and have a more offline conversation. It's up.
Yeah.
Again,
good.
It's also
we'll work on it.
Yeah. I would say also the one of the advantages of just tweaking organization is that you can at least somewhat avoid the issues of when you start changing things, everyone is, oh man, you're changing the precedent. When you're reorganizing, at least at the beginning, we're not changing anything except removing redundancies. And assuming there, you hope you won't come up with the same, oh, you're changing something that's important or not important, or you're omitting or adding. But the reality is, I think that's something we can do. Then the question is, how else do you move forward? Thank you. And that's, I will roughly time, 2 minutes early. But is there anything else to add or close with? Fantastic. I have a great evening. Let's see the stop show.
Oh, I have a question.
Sure.
What determines whether we get food or not?
That's a wonderful question. I told the office assemblies to have, we had a standing food order. Last meeting, this meeting, I think, was the snow. Last meeting, I don't know. I will be happy to talk to Pam and Gina. Also, a question, just for curiosity. Pizza, I do because I think my daughter would like it. We can certainly change to Thai food or other food.
Thai food?
Okay.
I mean, they never bring the anchovies. We could like go to Rose House and just like have the meetings there.
So I will follow the food. Once we can figure out more permanent time, I will be sure I talk to Pam and make sure that we actually have the order. But anything else? In that case, thank you very much for coming. I hope you all have a safe and warm evening. Thank you for coming. So have a good night, everyone. It's 4. It's what? 5:44. We're done. So for the record.
No, I was kidding. Okay.
I do like this show.
But so, I am serious. Like,
no, I absolutely don't.
Okay. I only have 10 credits.
Okay.
And I see a journal election on Friday. So after that, I have to go to the news. So I take the bar.
Wonderful
so.
Thing. I'd be happy to. I was looking at it and I was going, without sounding like a jerk, this committee can do a lot of things with our list of what we can do.
Yeah.
And saying, well, how can we make positive progress and set ourselves up to do better later?
Exactly.
And, well, piecemeal, the problem is the code is, and the offenses are in five spaces.
Yeah.
So, therefore, the piecemeal with the offenses, you're changing only anyways.
Mm-hmm.
So, which means, okay, if I can organize the offenses, and then we can start figuring out, okay,
yeah.
Like titles for 2 and 3. I essence distinguish between defenses against a person versus a university.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're in a single sentence.
Yeah.
The following offense is there against the university. The following offense